only reason I remember this guy, this little thing here that says record, record, that I pull out. That's how I remember. We do what we gotta do, right? So bear with me for one sec, folks. And by the way, I'd love to hear, I mean to always say this, if there's anything, I mean, I'm going to try, I've sort of been a little not bringing guest teachers as much recently for whatever reason, so I'm going to do that again or try to do that. I'm talking to some people, which just hasn't gelled yet, but in terms of what I offer, is anything you all are interested in, please tell me, you know, email me, talk about it. I'm very much want to hear from people what I might offer that would be helpful. I try to tune in and keep my antenna up and sort of follow my intuition about what I think might be good. But just want to throw that out there. And I want to talk this time and next time in different ways about purity of mind, about cultivating mind, because it's a way to look at our practice that can be really very helpful. And you know, have you ever, I don't know if people would read my stuff, I always wish don't read it.
I get through it faster.
Yeah, I know, don't do that. I'll make the type small. So, because I the people in Zoom world don't know that I have it off on the side here as a, it's not a Word file, let's say, anyway, it's in text. But, you know, when we sit down to meditate, often whatever is in the background, that's what arises, the garbage of our minds perhaps. And that's sometimes kind of alarming, you know, because people sit down and they think it's going to be pure, and then they find out what's really going on underneath. So, but that's helpful because it helps us see what the practice is. It's like washing the windows, you know, it's like clearing away so that we can go deeper. And in the process, we have to unpeel the onion. You know, we got to unpeel the onion about all our stuff and our thoughts and our compulsions and our desires and our hatreds and our traumas and the whole ball of wax. But part of that is how much we've been cultivating wholesome mind or not. There's a whole area of that that has a lot to do with what we do. And to help see how much that has to do with our journey on the journey is really important, because we can sort of think that that's like, oh, that's just the simple stuff, but it's actually not. It's like the core stuff. It's like the foundation upon we build a house is how we conduct our lives in body, speech, and mind. And so this kind of gives us some direction about how to live our lives. You know, that's why Sila is so important. That's why the three higher trainings is Sila and mindfulness. Not I got it right? No, I'm not sure. Sila, mindfulness, and concentration. Yeah, I think that's it. What's that?
Sila, concentration, and panna. Why wisdom?
Wisdom, yeah, okay. And that's what I sort of meant by mindfulness is the wisdom, but yes. So without cultivating wholesome mind, without really working on that, our practice will go nowhere. And also it can really run off a cliff. I mean, we all know of, you know, sadly here in the West, but there's been a lot of teachers who are on one aspect very awakened and have a lot of wisdom and insight. And then ethically they screw up, or in terms of the conditions of their minds, they do things not so good. And a lot of people get hurt. And sort of the end of the story for them as a teacher. So it's very important in a whole bunch of levels. You know, Pema Chodron, she says we have to start where we are. And that's so important. And here in the West, you know, being around Dharma circles for a lot of years, it's a real inclination of people to want to focus on the highest teachings of any spiritual tradition. Like people talk about Dzogchen all the time. And some people talk about Dzogchen often, But within Nyingma tradition, that's like the ninth jhana. It's like at the end of an enormous progression of practice over decades and decades for monastics, usually, or sequestered practitioners. And so some, you know, 45-year-old Westerner says, oh, okay, I want to learn Dzogchen, and without realizing how much is underneath it. So we got to keep looking at how much is underneath and then balance that with whatever we aspire to. You know, same with Theravada tradition is all, you know, not self and how we understand that, and trying to work with the jhanas, which some people can do and some people aren't, but got to get the basic stuff. So this wholesomeness of mind takes us toward the ultimate goal of Nibbana. And it helps when we understand this to think that the ways in which the Buddha's path is subtractive, it means it's taking away problems so that we can reveal what's underneath. It's not like, you know, in more theistic traditions, people are pointing at this thing that they're trying to grab on. You know, I'm not saying it's a derogatory way, but they're trying to connect with God, or there's something up they're trying to get toward. But in Buddhist tradition, we're more letting go and peeling away, and then that which was hidden emerges. So it's subtractive. We're not building to awakening. You know, you don't accomplish awakening. Awakening is revealed. And, you know, by the way, we don't awaken, just awakening happens. There's no I who awakens anyway. And the, you know, the tricky thing about the, I don't know, additive model of spiritual path is that people, there's the peril of opinions and ideas, because you, you know, we start where we are, and then we have this idea about where we're going, and we sort of hang on to that and then defend it and think it's right and someone else is wrong, and it gets full of opinions. But in terms of just the path of unfolding and awakening, then it clarifies over time, and people sort of move in the same direction, and they find out it's inherently so. But we need to have this purity underlying that, or this to have the dross cleaned out in terms of our own body, speech, and mind, and how we conduct our lives. So it's you know, we probably should be emphasizing that more than we do for all of us on the path and for what's taught, which is sort of why I thought I'd share a little bit. And, you know, the Buddha saw that our potential for awakening, it's hidden behind layers of obscurations, and he always referred to many lifetimes. I guess I should do this thing, shouldn't I? You all, it doesn't matter, never mind. Take it back, just get on gallery. I have to like think, what is this screen doing here, and then what are your screens doing there, and play off, because there's two different screen realities. Anyway, accumulated for lifetimes, like we don't know, and some of us may or may not think rebirth is correct, and that's all good. Buddha certainly constantly refers to that in terms of how he works with people, so maybe. But in a sense, we look at our practice as learning, like moment by moment, non-grasping. That's part of what mindfulness does for us. Something comes up, you see it, mindful of it, don't grasp. That's like the whole process of practice is kind of like that. Things arise, we become aware of them, and then we not grasp, not cling. And that means we're peeling away that which is not ultimate. I just learned a new word. You probably already know, but I don't know how to pronounce it. Apophatic. Does anybody know that word? Apophatic? I just learned it. It's an actual word that has to do with spiritual practice, which is on the letting go approach to spiritual practice. It shows up in Christian mysticism a lot, but a Buddhist friend of mine, Jason, actually introduced me to that word. So that's my new favorite word. But apathetic. So that's help how we move in this practice. And if we can't keep doing that peeling, then we get stuck in places, you know, and we'll adhere to things and think that's us and have trouble letting go. So, because we can get caught between attachment and aversion and ignorance, the three poisons. So this business of purification is exactly the business of awakening. Bhikkhu Bodhi, the great translator, He says, in the Buddha's teachings, the criteria of genuine enlightenment lies precisely in purity of mind. The purpose of all insight and enlightened understanding is to liberate the mind from the defilements, and Nibbana itself, the goal of the teaching, is defined quite clearly as freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion. So that's, you know, right in this arena. And this Bhikkhu Bodhi, who, as most of you know, is one of the foremost translators of the suttas. And a beautiful sutta, which you feel free to check out, is Majjhima Nikaya number 7, the simile of the cloth. And it's right talking about this arena, this area. And the essential simile in the sutta is that just as we can't dye a piece of cloth a clear and vivid color if it's dirty, we also can't awaken unless our minds are clean. Same way of seeing things. And we can think about that with cloth, you know, it's got to be clean to have it be a good color. The Buddha says, and I always read a bit from the suttas here, Buddha says in the suttas, Bhikkhu, suppose a cloth was defiled and stained and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine, it would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination can be expected. When the mind is undefiled, a happy destination can be expected. And I love it. He's talking about happy too, because that's something we, you know, keep reminding ourselves in the path. We're talking about happy is part of what happens with awakening. When we're not caught in the three poisons, it's also a joyful thing, a happy thing. So it's kind of a relief in a way. You know, I find this area of practice, because it makes the way forward less esoteric and more sort of doable to be able to work on this aspect of it. You know, should we, all these big existential questions, should we be monastics or not? Should we go on a 3-month retreat or not? Doesn't really matter. What matters is for our minds to be clean, to have some purity there. Or put another way, we could be on retreat or in robes, or, you know, be a famous teacher with a soiled mind, and it wouldn't bear much fruit and it would kind of backfire. But if our minds are, as much as we can, you know, clean and unsticky, keep cultivating that, even in the middle of a traffic jam in Brooklyn or whatever you have to do, you know, in the middle of a deadline online, washing the dishes, that's what counts. It's cleaning of the mind. And it's three aspects of behavior, body, speech, and mind. It comes up constantly in Tibetan practice when they're prostrating, they're bowing to body and body, speech, and mind all the time. And they're the body and speech are like the visible manifestations of our minds, you know, our intent. While mind itself is hidden and it manifests. So it gets interesting because body, you know, maybe hard to do, but it's obvious what we're doing or not. But mind is hidden. You know, you ever, there's these jokes sometimes where someone's like sitting with a great master. I think Ram Dass has said some really funny things where he's sitting with a great master and kind of wincing at what was going on in his mind that the person didn't know, except it turned out he did. But, you know, how often are we with someone we respect and we've kind of realized what's going on in our minds, our own junk, our own obsessions, whatever they are, and want it to be clearer. And sometimes you may have had this experience, but in the presence of highly awakened beings, there's something about the energy coming at us that can make stuff come up. I've had that in some very embarrassing ways a few times over the years. Embarrassing to me. So it just shows you that how important this is, how we can really work on this, that we have this detritus floating around, probably all of us, you know, and to be able to cultivate clearing that, how important that is. And it's right here, you know, in these moment by moment arisings and passings that mindfulness can recognize unwholesome thoughts and cultivate it, and first recognize them so we don't get so sticky about them, and then cultivate alternatives, if that seems reasonable. But at least the mindfulness of it just takes the teeth out of it. You know, it helps us becoming so grabbed from it. And then it becomes sometimes kind of obvious, oh yeah, let's think something different. Let's change that, replace that thought with the other side. Replace hatred with love, or grasping with letting go. And this isn't, you know, it's always good. This isn't about sin or something, or good or evil. It's just cultivating conditions for awakening, just cultivating conditions for being at peace. And the list of defilements, as listed by the Buddha in the simile of the cloth, are pretty interesting. He says, what bhikkhus are the imperfections that defile the mind? Covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence are imperfections that defile the mind. It's quite a list. 17 imperfections. And I bet all of us here have ways that we've done some of those or most of those at times. I know I have. So you look at them through the lens of how they color the mind in maybe two ways, I suggest, especially from working with the sutta. And one's in terms of the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion, and how these color our mind. And we look at those like greed or hatred, how a kind of a pallor covers your mind. You ever look at that? Like see how you are when your mind is bright and aware, and then see when whatever it is that captures you, how the tone of your mind changes. It's almost like a cloud cover, or like a gray mist. It's very visceral, and you can feel it dimming the light of your awareness. Yeah, I see a lot of Carol nodding over there. Yeah, right, it's pretty powerful, huh? And the more you tune into that, it becomes, oh, I don't want to do that, you know, and it becomes like something we self-correct just because it ain't helpful. But to begin to tune into how it colors and shifts, and how that's in the context of the three poisons, is really interesting. And sometimes there might be some little subtle, this is where it gets like a razor's edge, you know, all this stuff, some little subtle choice that we might make, like a quarter left on the table, do we pick it up or not? Or the last slice of cake at some kind of event, and do we eat it or not? And watch what happens in our minds when we do. I've eaten the last slice of cake, and I remember thinking, I could just see, whoa, that's amazing. You know, I don't do it anymore, I hope. But, you know, you can see all the stuff going on, and how can we kind of put ourselves before someone else, and you can sort of, and you just sort of feel this little kind of, almost this like clutching defensiveness going on, and this sort of shutting down. It's pretty amazing. So right in those kind of things, it's really powerful, and it's a stepping stone on the path towards awakening. So these things are totally important, and it's kind of like a gray smoke. And then you look at people who habitually make those kinds of choices, and you can feel that they're sadly, you know, pretty drowned or lost in a kind of a darkness. It's going to be a while. You know, and, you know, a lot of times that happens with, you know, people who are really addicted, whatever that means, to power or money or substances, and how they put that ahead of other people. And it ends up becoming a very self looking for a sensation kind of thing. And it covers their ability to really see, to have intuition and to awaken. So it takes away our freedom. It takes away our freedom when we get ourselves stuck in those places. And so you can see how any moment of these imperfections of body, speech, and mind is heading in the opposite direction of our spiritual practice. Instead of awakening, we're dimming. So it gives us a lot of room for choice, which is so cool. Because then we can wake up, and the more we're able to be mindful and see, you know, the part of us that really wants the last piece of cake. But then you can kind of see, oh, what is that? It's like this taste thing. It's this grasping thing. It's, you can feel the little buzz in our body that wants it. And it's like, oh, it's not such a big deal. And then another aspect related is how these 17 imperfections perhaps have to do with selfing. You know, the way we are, I mean, it's related, but how we concretize self around it and want something for me, therefore ahead of other, like insolence, envy, deceit, conceit, to list some of them from the Buddhist lists. They're all based on holding on to a sense of self, kind of grasping that, putting that self ahead of others, wanting ourself to be first. That's why, you know, we envy something, because we want that thing that someone else has. We want the one, we want to be the one that has it. Or deceit, you know, most of the time people deceive somebody because there's some reward that they're going to get, something tangible that they'll get out of lying or whatever it is. That's why people do that. And every time they do that, they're creating self. It's like they're like tightening up. They're like creating a sense of self right there. That is the thing that they want to have, what it wants. But it's not actually inherently there, as we see from practice. You know, it's something that we create in moments of grasping. The Buddha said, knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. Knowing that ill will, negligence, is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. So it's that same idea, just ain't helpful. It's like, you know, dropping an anvil on your toe is not helpful, so you would abandon it. And in the same way, this isn't helpful. So it's not, you know, we sort of feel like, oh, we're not going to get the thing we want. We're not going to get the yacht. We're not going to, whatever it is we want. You know, and it feels like a null, like that's why, renunciation has a bad name, because it seems like it's sort of tamping down the fun of life. But one could argue, the wrong word maybe, suggest that this is like an uplift, you know, it's a joy and a freedom that this leads to, ultimately. That's why we're on the path. That's why, you know, we're practitioners, because we kind of know that. So this uplift is one of those hints of non-clinging. It kind of gives us a sense of the way forward to happiness. And it's that very arena of happiness that the Buddha experienced under the rose apple tree. You know, when he was a child, he was practicing, some of you know, he settled into a meditation and felt happy and saw, and he looked back on that when he was an ascetic and realized that there was a way toward that could emerge from practice. The sutta says about this direction, it says one gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When one is glad, rapture is born in one. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. One who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. So it's kind of a, I don't know, a paradox, a puzzle, a key to the path, that gladness emerges from non-selfing, because most people feel like, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins kind of thing, but it's just the opposite. Gladness emerges from non-selfing. And it's interesting in this little sequence here, it's walking toward concentration, you know, and I'm missing something, but anyway, how the sequence of pleasure leads to concentration, pleasure of that inner peace. Yep. From purity of mind to gladness to sukha, and then towards concentration. This is baked into the sutta. And concentration in concert with mindfulness, you know, it gives us insight into the nature of things, or the central parts of meditation. And with the last thing that's kind of really interesting about this sutta is how it links this purity of mind to this other aspect of awakening, which is loving kindness and compassion. And those are the two wings of awakening, wisdom and compassion. And here it kind of brings them together. And this purity of mind helps us also cultivate loving kindness and compassion for others, because we're not, you know, adhered to our own desires. We become kinder. The sutta says, one abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, with a mind imbued with equanimity, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, oneself, one abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. So I think it's really significant how this, in this, you know, there's all kinds of different ways and avenues that are touched on in the suttas in different ways, but in this one, how these Brahmaviharas emerge out of this cultivating of purity of mind. So it just means, you know, what we think. The attitudes that we hold in our minds have everything to do with our progress on the path, and it's a real area that we can work on and encounter in other parts of our lives and sort of think of how we practice in terms of this aspect, the wholesome thoughts, just what we're doing, body, speech, and mind, and how we're doing it. And it also means the actions we take are linked to our progress on the path. And it becomes, what did the Padmasambhava is great. He was 9th century, brought Buddhism into Tibet, and he said, the mind should be as vast as space, your actions as fine as barley flour. I always think that's great, because it sort of touches on this whole idea of, you know, vast as space is like the ultimate pinnacle of Dzogchen, but his actions as fine as barley flour means to really, with great subtlety, look at the tonal qualities of how the choices we make and how much they're selfish and how much they are. And it gets subtler and subtler, as we all know. We progress on the path, and the whole arena of ethical choices and wholesome mind gets subtler and subtler. It gets to be a kind of a knife edge, but in a good way. And at the end of the suttas, this very interesting exchange where this, I can't pronounce this right, but this Brahmin, because this is all in India, right? And this was, pretty sure this was it. Jetavana Monastery. Anyway, this Brahmin, Sandarkiya Bahadarva, sitting next to the Buddha, and he asked the Buddha if he's going to go to the Bahuka River to bathe. Now, I haven't heard of the Bahuka River, but y'all, probably a lot of you know that in Hinduism, people go to the Ganges and they bathe to purify. That's what the great Kumbh Mela is about. I mean, it's all good. But it's a real, in that traditional real idea of you go to this river and you bathe. And the Buddha's, he's so interesting. He sort of plays ignorant and asks why. Why would you want to go to the river to bathe? And the Brahmin says, well, it'll wash away evil actions. And then the Buddha says, a fool may there forever bathe, yet it will not purify dark deeds. You cannot purify an evildoer. A man who has done cruel and brutal deeds, when pure in heart, has evermore the feast of spring, the holy day. When fair in act, when pure in heart, brings virtue to perfection. It is here, Brahman, that you should bathe, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is offered not, with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to go to Gaia? For any well will be your Gaia. I think I just love that last little bit. Gaia's right near Bodh Gaya, and that's a sacred city in Hinduism too. So he's sort of saying, you know, what you have to do is don't work harm for living beings, don't take what isn't offered. You don't have to go to this sacred place and bathe there. You just have to watch your mind and make ethical choices. So here in 2022, that's a way we can work on the path. Let's sit for a moment.